good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
To sum it up, Palestinians continue to rely on Israel's approval of their technology equipment, and that explains why, for example, Palestinians still run on 3G while the world has made it to 4G and 5G.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. Palestinians are increasingly turning to social media to highlight what life is like under Israeli military rule. For example, weeks before Israel's bombing campaign in Gaza, Palestinian activists in Jerusalem used social media to shine a spotlight on Israel's ethnic cleansing of the Sheikh Jarrah community, using the hashtag #SaveSheikhJarrah. What happened next was a global movement for Palestine never seen before across social media platforms. During Israel's bombing campaign, social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok were removing, censoring, or deleting accounts that posted Palestinian content. Hamle, a Palestinian nonprofit focused on social media, has documented more than 500 reports of Palestinian digital rights violations in May alone, marking a significant increase in the censorship of Palestinian political speech and narrative online. To help us better understand what is happening, we are joined today by Marwa Fatafta. Marwa is a policy analyst with Al Shabaka. Welcome, Marwa. Welcome to This is Palestine.
Thank you, Deanna, for hosting me.
So, Marwa, I want to begin by asking you, what is going on with Facebook, with Instagram, with TikTok? What's happening here?
What we have seen with the rise of violence in Palestine, we've seen social media content that belongs to Palestinians in the beginning around the campaign Save Sheikh Jarrah being taken down on Instagram in huge volume. We're talking about thousands of content being removed, then even though Instagram apologized, saying, sorry, it's a technical error that resulted in removal of stories, Palestinian activists and their allies continued to report their content being removed, their live streaming on Instagram being disrupted or blocked. Content is not allowed to be even uploaded to the platforms. Certain functions on those platforms also being disabled for users, as if they are being penalized for posting pro-Palestinian content. So you, for example, wouldn't be able to like, comment, or share a post. You're threatened that your account might be deleted. We've seen also on Twitter, for example, tens of accounts being disabled or suspended. The most prominent example that comes to mind is the suspension of the Palestinian journalist Maryam Barghouti while she was tweeting from a live from a demo near Beit Il in Ramallah. And, you know, if we bring in the different stories and the different pieces together of what happened on social media, one could say that there was a sort of a mass censorship of Palestinian content on those platforms. It took different shapes and forms, but even though the companies continue to dodge acknowledging those actions, pinning it on a technical error or a system glitch, unfortunately, till today, we continue to hear from users that their content is being censored, removed, their accounts being suspended. And there are also some insidious ways in the way that their content is not reaching out to people. So they might be actually shadow banned. So that's, in a nutshell, what we have been documenting over the past few weeks on social media.
And do you think, Marwa, that it's a glitch, or do you think that there's something bigger there?
I think it doesn't really matter whether it's a system glitch or not. Those companies have resources, both financial and human resources, that would be should enable them to investigate what went wrong and ensure to fix that as soon as possible, which didn't happen. I think that there are a number of factors coming into play here. On the one hand, the content moderation policies that disproportionately target and censor Palestinians, and then the way those policies are being implemented using automation and machine learning tools that are blind to context and nuance. So you're entrusting a machine that doesn't really understand local speech to moderate that speech. So the expectation here is a mass failure and mass censorship. And I think, you know, the technical error is a convenient excuse that would absolve those companies from their responsibilities. But at this point, it just demonstrates the inability of those platforms to protect their users, protect their freedom of expression, especially at critical times, as we have seen in the past few weeks in Palestine.
So maybe let's go back a little bit, and I want to ask you about equal access to social media. How powerful is digital organizing, and what's the role of social media as a tool for organizing?
In 1984, Edward Said made that famous argument that Palestinians were denied the permission to narrate. And this is especially true when one takes a quick look at international headlines where Palestinians are usually dehumanized, vilified, or even made responsible for the oppression and violence inflicted on them by the Israeli occupation. And I think, you know, without sounding hyperbole, social media liberated that space to a certain extent and provided Palestinians the breathing space to narrate their story, transmit to the world their reality as it is, bypassing the hands of editorial boards, and document police brutality, Israeli human rights abuses, and war crimes. And to that extent, I think social media has been a lifeline for Palestinians existing on the front lines, in Sheikh Jarrah, in Gaza, in the West Bank, but also for those living in the diaspora. And I think such documentation is important because it provides a protection and brings on accountability, if not now, for the future. And let's not also forget that there is an ICC investigation underway, and that documentation is important for such investigations and to bring in justice and accountability. Invisibility breeds impunity, and it's no coincidence that many oppressive regimes kill the switch when there are mass protests. And even though in Palestine we didn't really see any internet shutdowns, but we've seen, you know, as we discussed, the ways in which Palestinian voices have been censored or restricted on social media. And so it provides the space where Palestinians can organize, build on solidarity, connect with other social movements around the world. And we've seen the effect of that, which is a shift in the narrative and a breakthrough, let's say, the walls of that international media and that monopoly that Israel has enjoyed over the narrative and what exactly is happening right now in Palestine when it comes to ethnic cleansing, when it comes to apartheid, when it comes to the war crimes being committed in Gaza and so on.
Even though there are some inroads being made on social media in terms of getting Palestinian voices out, we are still facing a great deal of censorship, but also not just censorship in terms of words, but Israel controlling our internet infrastructure. Can you speak to that a little bit?
This is an extremely important point, because when we talk about digital repression in the context of Palestine, we're not talking about social media, even though that's the most present example. And it's important to understand the wider context in which Palestinians, obviously, among other things, have been denied the right to have access and ownership of their own ICT infrastructure. Before the Oslo Accords and the PA coming into existence, the Palestinians, of course, relied on the Israeli IC infrastructure. Obviously, there wasn't internet before the 90s. However, in terms of telecommunications, cell towers and whatnot, Palestinians have relied on Israel's supply. But with the Oslo Accords, there was an agreement that Israel would transfer that responsibility to the Palestinians. However, Israel maintains, for security reasons, the sole authority to approve any import of technology to the Palestinian Authority and any installation of that technology on Palestinian land. And here we're talking about Area A primarily, which is governed by the PA. And it's a bit of a catch-22, really, because if I remember the clause in the Oslo Accords correctly, Palestinians would have the full ownership of their ICT infrastructure only when they can prove that they're able to do so. But when you can't import and install the equipment, you can't really have, and you're not able to develop that infrastructure. So to sum it up, Palestinians continue to rely on Israel's approval of their technology equipment. And that explains why, for example, Palestinians still run on 3G while the world has made it to 4G and 5G. And of course, every time Israel doesn't give a convincing reason, it's always the usual security reason, which doesn't really explain what is it exactly that would threaten Israel's security with Palestinians having access to 4G. It's a form of de-development, but also it's a form of control and digital occupation, because when you have full control over the ICT infrastructure, it also means that you are able to surveil on Palestinian private communications, on their internet and their use of the internet pretty freely and without any barriers. And so Israel has maintained the upper hand over Palestinian internet sphere and the way they use it and the way they communicate. And as you know, Deanna, Palestinians have been a subject to one of the world's most invasive surveillance operations. There is no legal barrier or even moral barrier to the ways in which the Israeli intelligence and Israeli military forces ability to surveil, invade the privacy of Palestinians, or even collecting the most intimate parts or details of their lives, including their financial status, their health condition, their sexual orientation, as well as, of course, their political beliefs, and using those against them, sometimes even to recruit collaborators, for example, if they know that you are a Palestinian gay living in Gaza. And coming from a conservative family, this is an interesting piece of information that could definitely be used against you to recruit you, maybe to collaborate with the Israeli forces. And that has been, you know, well documented over the years. And so within this ecosystem, one can understand why Palestinians rely on social media, because that's probably the only viable space where they can communicate freely. And I wanted to bring in here another element, maybe less intrusive, but nevertheless important to highlight, which is the Palestinian Authority's own control over the internet sphere. You know, the Palestinian Authority passed a draconian cybercrime law in 2017. It was amended in 2018, a year later, after a strong push from Palestinian civil society because of the way it allows the Palestinian Authority and the public prosecutor to interpret speech online and use extremely vague and over broad words and provisions like national security and public order and whatnot to interpret speech and prosecute and arrest activists and journalists as they see fit. And within that framework, we can also highlight that the Palestinian Authority itself has blocked over, I think, 60 websites so far that belong to their opponents, whether they're affiliated with Hamas or they are critical of the PA and could publish, for example, articles that expose the PA's corruption or just critical of their policies and positions when it comes to the Palestinian cause. And so all of this to say, again, and emphasize that social media probably is the only space where Palestinians could express themselves freely. However, still with repercussions, because you could be prosecuted and arrested by either the Israeli authorities or by the Palestinian Authority, or your content can be taken down because now social media companies are playing a role in censoring and policing speech themselves on their platforms.
Can you speak a little bit more about the social media companies and their content moderation and how these policies impact Palestinian human rights? You mentioned already that Mariam Barghouti, for example, her Twitter account was blocked for a period of time during the height of the Israeli attack on Gaza, and also during the protests that were happening in Sheikh Jarrah. And we've also seen journalists like Jamal Dejani and intellectuals like Asad Abu Khalil and activists such as Yunus Arrar, who've had their accounts blocked either temporarily or permanently. Can you speak a little bit about how these social media companies, how their policies impact Palestinian human rights and how these algorithms are working?
Social media companies have the responsibility to moderate content on their platforms. And each of those companies have developed their own set of rules. In Facebook, they're called community standards, which to a certain degree give the user an understanding of what is allowed and not allowed on those platforms. When it comes to Palestinian content, there have been a number of policies, non-transparent policies that govern Palestinian speech, which you won't see on their websites. You won't see, for example, the so-called Zionist policy or the Shahid policy on Facebook. But we know about those policies first by experience. If you speak to Palestinian journalists or activists, they would tell you, you know, posts that are describing Hamas or including words related to Hamas are often taken down, even or including journalistic content. Some posts that are critical of the Zionist narrative or include even the word Zionist can also be taken down. But with through consultations with those companies, I later realized and understood that there are actual policies in play here. And what's worrying about those policies, in addition to the fact that they're not transparent, none of us, you know, ordinary users that use those platforms every day know about the existence of such policies. And here I'm talking about Facebook primarily. It's the most popular platform used by Palestinians, and it's one of the platforms where we've documented a number of policies that disproportionately target Palestinians, as opposed to, for example, Twitter. So in addition to the fact that they're non-transparent, they are also problematic in the way they interpret speech. And here, those US-based companies have a very restrictive and one-sided interpretation of Palestinian speech. I'll give you an example. So one of those problematic policies I'm talking about is the so-called Shahid policy, which falls under a mother policy developed by Facebook called the Dangerous Individuals and Organizations. This policy basically bans the use of the platform by those so-called dangerous individuals and organizations, and also bans the support, praise of those individuals and organizations. One might ask, who are these people and who are these organizations? Facebook doesn't provide an answer. There is no public list of those banned individuals and orgs. However, we know that Facebook, for example, complies with the US State Department's list of foreign terrorist organizations. So anyone who's on there is blacklisted by Facebook. This includes Hamas, this includes the Islamic Jihad, includes, I think, also PFLP. And that explains why, for example, Leila Khaled, who belongs to the PLFP, was banned last year on Facebook, YouTube, and even Zoom when she was hosted by San Francisco State University for an academic event. And if you, for example, as a user, describe someone like Ghassan Kanafani as Shaheed, Facebook interprets that as a glorification of terrorism or praise and support for terrorism. If you use the word Shaheed to describe someone who has been, again, you know, killed in the conflict but belongs to Hamas or Islamic Jihad, Facebook interprets that as glorification of terrorism. And that's extremely problematic because, one, Facebook is not a judicial authority to decide whether certain political speech is legitimate or not. And the way that they interpret those words, to me, reminds me how the Israeli authorities are interpreting Palestinian speech themselves. You know, one example that comes to mind is the prosecution of Darin Tatur, you know, the Palestinian poet with Israeli citizenship. She was arrested in October 2015 after she published a poem on Facebook titled Resist My People Resist. It was in Arabic, but that's the English translation of her poem. And so the prosecution and the interrogation of her poem was based on a Hebrew translation of that poem. And here's the thing. So she, you know, she had the poem together with a video where there are children throwing stones. And the Hebrew translation of the poem. Translated, for example, the word martyr, shahid, as terrorist. And the way that the Israeli prosecution and interrogators basically proceeded with the entire prosecution and the legal proceedings with that interpretation, they made, you know, they basically added expressions to her that she didn't actually say. And this brings me back to the Shaheed policy. How can you synonymize the word Shaheed, which means a martyr, is part of the Palestinian lexicon, not even the Palestinian lexicon, it's part of the wider Arab lexicon, with the word terrorism or the word terrorist? And I can see those linkages between how the Israeli authorities interpret Palestinian speech and how that interpretation being adopted by social media companies. And then when we talk about, you know, in addition to the fact that the Facebook is interpreting words like shaheed and muqawama, which means resistance, or even worse, how they see and interpret the word Zionism, which they make it synonymous with Jewish and Israeli, and therefore when you criticize, or to them, if you attack Zionists, then you are attacking Israelis and Jews, and therefore that content is considered hate speech, also taken down. So when you add those policies with the way, or to the way social media companies enforce those policies, now we're talking about the use of automation and machine learning, this is like a recipe for mass censorship. Because you are scrutinizing words that would require a specialized understanding of the context in order to understand whether this piece of content is legitimate speech or actually could be, you know, anti-Semitic speech or hate speech or incitement to violence, because that does exist on those platforms. You know, we don't want to downplay the problem, but when you entrust that capacity or that responsibility, which requires nuance and understanding, to a machine that doesn't really understand and is not capable of analyzing and getting the context right, then the result is a lot of content being taken down, flagged obviously by the automation, and taken down automatically. And this is why when we escalate cases to Facebook, in many cases, those cases are flagged as false positives, meaning that they haven't actually violated any community standards or terms of services, but they were flagged wrongly by the machine and taken down. Unfortunately, with the COVID-19 happening in 2020, and a lot of content moderators have to work from home, social media companies relied on automation even more. And that is problematic for many reasons. You know, for one, those algorithms are non-transparent. They continue to be a black box, despite of calls from civil society organizations working on digital rights that there needs to be a certain degree of algorithmic transparency because of those accountability reasons. You know, we want to understand when and how are you using automation and how those algorithms are negatively impacting people's rights, fundamental rights to, and especially the right to freedom of expression. And what's the error rate? Are they actually accurate? Are they discriminatory, as we see in the case of Palestine? They often err on the side of overreach and overcorrection. And in other areas, interestingly, you'll see that there is a lack of enforcement. When we talk about hate speech and incitement to violence happening on the Israeli side, there has been little enforcement by social media companies. Often that content remains on the platform for days, and if not ever removed. We've seen Israeli officials and politicians explicitly calling for violence, in some cases even explicitly calling for Palestinian genocide, using disinformation. You know, during the war in Gaza, Netanyahu's spokesperson on Twitter published a couple of times disinformation videos that one video in particular I remember was an old video from Syria, and the spokesperson used it as a so-called evidence to show that Hamas is using or firing rockets from civilian areas, which is basically to, you know, it's the usual Israeli line to justify their indiscriminate bombardment of Palestinian civilian areas, which, as you know, are heavily populated in Gaza. And that content, even though we flagged it and many people wrote to Twitter, you know, what is going on? And it was a few days later, it was marked as manipulated media. And I suspect that the user or the person himself deleted that tweet when it was flagged as such. But it shows you like the disparity of how social media companies are applying the rules to different people and different communities, where marginalized and oppressed communities are the first to suffer from the discrimination of those algorithms and the inequality in the application of those terms of services, even though social media companies say that their standards and rules are universal and apply to all of their users. But the reality is Palestinian voices are heavily censored and restricted, while we see hate speech and racism remaining on the Israeli sphere without being touched or moderated.
So Marwa, this is the million-dollar question, which is, what can we do about it?
I think at this point, you know, from a civil society perspective, as someone who works on digital rights, and yeah, it's a $1 million question that I ask myself every day. I think at this point, we are asking social media companies, especially Facebook, we're demanding a public audit of all of their content moderation policies and actions related to Israel and Palestine. You know, those policies that I mentioned to you as examples, like the Zionist policy or the Shahid policy, are just the tip of the iceberg. And we know about them, again, not because Facebook publishes those, but because they sometimes reach out to civil society for so-called consultations, but those consultations are sometimes arbitrary. You don't really understand when and how they approach you for consultation in the life of that kind of policy development. Sometimes, as in the Zionist policy, it's been implemented since 2019, but we were consulted on that in early 2021. So we really need to understand what exactly is going on within Facebook and other companies when it comes to their decisions regarding Palestine and Palestinian content. Which words are they banning? Which words are they blacklisting? Who are those dangerous individuals and organizations? We want that list public. If you don't know who is being banned on the platform, how are you supposed to, as a user, how are you supposed to conduct yourself accordingly? We are also want to see transparency on the use of those algorithms. We want to understand when and how they use them to moderate Palestinian content. And also, one particular demand is to allow users, when their content is being flagged and taken down, to repeal and have a very clear and transparent appeal process, where there's a human specialized team that could look into that grievance and be able to address it. We also demand that social media companies sit with grassroots activists, with human rights organizations, with civil society, in order to design their policies that govern the speech of communities together with them. You can't, as a US-based company at this point, just decide single-handedly that this word is banned and that word is not allowed. And if you want to express yourself as a Palestinian community, well, those are the contours of the discussion, or those are the rules that you have. You can't do that without speaking with those communities and co-design those policies together with them. To me, that's ultimately the way in which we can overcome those biased policies. And one last thing is, which we haven't discussed in the previous questions, we want to also bring to surface this special relationship between Israel and social media companies. As you know, the Israeli cyber unit, which sits within the Attorney General's office, has a so-called voluntary enforcement mechanism, which doesn't follow any legal proceedings, doesn't actually prove that certain speech is illegal according to Israeli law. Nevertheless, they report content to social media companies to be taken down or even accounts to be suspended in accordance to the platform's community standards. And as you know, Diana, a lot of content, Palestinian content, is being removed under the pretext of incitement to violence or terrorism or hate speech. And the requests that are being submitted by these cyber units to those companies are unfortunately not registered and not made transparent by the platforms. If you visit Facebook and Twitter and other companies, you'll see that they have made one positive step towards, you know, shining a light or providing a certain transparency on their relationship with governments and how governments make requests to the platforms to censor content. But those kind of transparency reports only include legal requests, requests that are backed by, you know, a certain legal procedure or a court order that show that within a certain jurisdiction, that particular piece of speech is illegal. So there's a judicial process. But in the case of the Israeli cyber unit, there's none of that. And therefore, Palestinians don't know whether their content is being removed on social media at the request of the Israeli government. We don't know how social media companies are complying with those requests. And so one of our basic demands right now is providing numbers and transparency on those types of requests. We want to understand how many of those requests social media companies receive. How are they complying with them? What is the type of content that is asked to be taken down, and so on and so forth. Without that kind of transparency, unfortunately, we will continue to run into the same issues and the same kind of digital repression where private companies based in the US deciding what is allowed and what isn't allowed on their platforms.
I want to thank you, Marwa, very much for this interview. I've learned a lot, and I'm certain others have as well. Please keep up the excellent work that you're doing in monitoring this. And thank you again for joining us on This Palestine.
Thank you so much, Diana. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org.
في الهوى رعاش والغنو دلع So it's like they've restricted not only where you can live, but not who you can marry. They're not going to tell you you can't marry someone, but they're going to make it very difficult for you to live a decent and more or less normal life if that person doesn't have the same idea as you. It's just all part and part of this, you know, this apartheid system.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Boutu. Today we will hear from Johara Becker, a journalist and activist, who will talk to us today about what it's like to live under Israel's family reunification laws. Johara is an American citizen who moved back to Palestine in the 1980s.
My parents are both Palestinian. I was born in the United States, and we moved back to Palestine when I was 11. So I didn't get Palestinian citizenship until after the Oslo Accords in 93, 94.
For Palestinians, moving back to Palestine is not an easy matter. Thousands of Palestinians returning from abroad, including those born in Palestine, are routinely denied the ability to live in or even enter Palestine. In Johara's case, given that she returned to Palestine before the establishment of the Palestinian Authority in 1994, and given that she had lived in Palestine as a child for a long period of time, she was among those who were given a Palestinian ID and hence a Palestinian passport. This identification card gives Johara the ability to live in the West Bank, but she needs an Israeli permit to be able to enter Jerusalem, to visit 48 Palestine, or to visit the Gaza Strip. Johara's brother and father, however, were not given such ID cards because they were living outside of the West Bank when the process of issuing ID cards began. In 1998, Johara married her husband, Musa. Musa is a Palestinian from Jerusalem, carrying a Jerusalem ID card and holding an Israeli travel permit. As a person carrying a Jerusalem ID card, Musa is not a citizen of Israel, but a permanent resident, even though generations of his family have lived in Jerusalem, in particular in the Old City. As a permanent resident, Musa must continually show that, as they put it, Jerusalem is the, quote, center of his life, unquote. He does this by producing stacks of documents to show that he is living in Jerusalem, everything from utility bills to property taxes and so on.
He has to prove that he lives, that we both live in Jerusalem, that he works, that he in the city, that the children, if there are any children, they have to be registered in Jerusalem schools, that you get medical insurance in the city, you pay taxes, you have. So we had to produce electricity bills, water bills, the land, and the property tax bills, the arnona. We had to, every year you have to have, there's a stack of papers that you have to provide. And you also have, you cannot have a house or live in the West Bank, because then they say that this is grounds for revoking my husband's, not mine, my husband's Jerusalem ID. And even though my Hawiya, my Palestinian ID remained the same, and the address, my residency address is still Elbira. It just says that I'm allowed to remain in Jerusalem, but virtually with no rights. I mean, you're not allowed to drive, you're not allowed to cross the borders, you're not allowed to work unless you get specific permits, and that's another long process. So yeah, that's what I got for 10 years, but it's very tenuous. You never know when they're going to deny it to you, which they did last year. So you never know. And then they just make some bogus excuse why they have put it on hold. And then you just have to wait. You're at their mercy at all times.
If he cannot produce these documents, or if he moves to the West Bank or abroad, Israel can revoke his permanent residency, preventing him from living in Jerusalem or even from entering the country. Since 1967, Israel has revoked the permanent residency of more than 14,000 Palestinians from Jerusalem. Incidentally, Jewish Israelis do not face similar problems. When Johara and Musa got married, Johara, remember, she needs a permit to enter Jerusalem, applied for a permit to live in Musa's family home in the old city of Jerusalem. But because Musa had previously been a political prisoner, her application was denied, and she was forced to reside illegally in her home for 11 years. What this meant was that Johara was unable to apply for or obtain her husband's permanent residency status, and instead would remain a West Bank Palestinian ID holder, needing Israeli permits to enter Jerusalem. During this period, Johara feared leaving her home. She was unable to drive or work, and she didn't have any health insurance. In effect, she was undocumented. But even though undocumented, the Israelis knew that she was living in Jerusalem because she had two children, born in 1999 and in 2002.
So my kids were born in Jerusalem, and I had to have had them in Jerusalem again so that they can be registered as Jerusalemites. Now, the thing is, with registering your children in the Interior Ministry to get the birth certificate, you have to go to the Interior Ministry. My husband does, not me. With my son, it wasn't as hard because that was at the end of 1999. And then, of course, in 2000, things started to blow up and things just got worse. So when my daughter was born in 2002, I didn't have a permit. I did have the baby in Al-Maqasid. And then my husband it took 10 months to get her birth certificate from the Interior Ministry. They kept asking us for more papers. Every time he would get there, they would say there was something missing. The thing is that if we had not secured it by year one, that my daughter turned one, then we would have had to apply for family reunification for her as well. So at least we got it by, when she was 10 months old, she finally got her birth certificate. So my children have Jerusalem IDs, but they, at this point, we had to keep them in school here. I could not have a house in the West Bank. And so they have secured that. But then we had the problem of if we ever wanted to travel outside of the country, we couldn't leave through the same borders because I don't have a Jerusalem ID. I couldn't use the airport. They couldn't cross through Jordan because they don't have Jordanian. So it's always been a real hassle. Now that they're adults, things are different. But this is kind of like the reality that we live in, that we lived with for years.
According to Israeli law, any person who is Jewish may make aliyah and become an Israeli citizen, effectively becoming an Israeli upon arrival. But for those who are not Jewish, the paths to becoming a citizen are extremely limited. You can only acquire citizenship if you are the child of a person who holds Israeli citizenship or if you marry an Israeli citizen. In the case of marrying a citizen, even then the process is not easy, often taking years for citizenship to be granted. But bear in mind that this process is for non-Jews only. Anyone who is Jewish can easily bypass this years-long process by making aliyah. Effectively, the process for acquiring citizenship through marriage is for non-Jews only, and it's not uncommon for the process to take 7 or more years. In 2003, Israel further amended its citizenship law by passing what they called a temporary law aimed at making the process for non-Jews to acquire citizenship even more difficult. Under the new law, any Israeli citizen or permanent resident who marries someone who holds a Palestinian ID, whether that person is from the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, cannot have their spouse reside in Jerusalem or in 48 and cannot obtain citizenship through the track of citizenship granted to spouses. In effect, what this meant is that for Musa, he would not be able to pass on his permanent residency to Johara. In 2007, the law was later amended to add the same restrictions on spouses from Iran, from Iraq, from Syria, and from Lebanon. What this has meant is that these couples face three choices. One, they can leave and live abroad. Two, the Israeli citizenship holding spouse can reside in the West Bank, though that is illegal for those with Israeli citizenship to live in Area A, and those holding Israeli citizenship cannot live in the Gaza Strip. Or three, the spouse with the Palestinian ID can reside illegally in Jerusalem or in 48. After the passage of the law, a minor amendment was issued allowing for those spouses with Palestinian ID cards to obtain temporary permits to reside in Jerusalem or in 48 if they were over the age of 25 in the case of women or over the age of 35 in the case of men.
For them, it's easier. The harder that they make your life, the faster that you're just going to give up on the whole process because it's a really long and stressful process to keep maintaining this permit. And they have revoked not just the ID, not just for the permits, they revoked the IDs. You have to have a really clean slate, in what they call a clean slate, in order to be approved. So for them, I'm sure it's just like, well, we'll just make it really difficult and then maybe they'll just give up and that's one less person to deal with in Jerusalem.
Yet these permits are precarious and must be renewed yearly. Those with permits are not allowed to work or drive and are not entitled to any benefits, including health insurance. Their family members from the West Bank or from the Gaza Strip are also required to apply for permits to come to visit them. Registering children married to what these referred to as mixed couples is also an uphill battle, with some parents needing to produce DNA records to demonstrate that the child is their biological child. In Joetta's case, although she married before the passage of the law, she's still not been able to obtain status in Jerusalem. Her youngest child is a university student, and yet Joetta remains in limbo. Though she was granted a permit a few years ago to be able to reside in Jerusalem, her permit was later revoked because of claims that she was, quote, inciting, unquote, a claim that has never been substantiated.
I mean, they have actually accused me of incitement, and that's why they suspended my permit the last time, but never actually said how I incited.
She now resides in Ramallah because she does not have a permit, but her husband lives in Jerusalem because he fears that if he moves to Ramallah, his permanent residency will also be revoked. When Joetta was able to obtain a permit, she still faced a multitude of restrictions. Here's Joetta talking about the inability to drive despite having two driver's licenses and the inability to travel with her kids and spouse through the airport, as well as the inability to work.
If my husband's traveling with us, he will travel out of the Lid airport with the children. If he's, and I travel via Amman because I have to cross the bridge, and then we meet wherever in Europe. If my husband, when my husband was not with me and the children were young, I remember there was one time I was taking them to the U.S. because so they can get their U.S. citizenship. I had to have my late father, he only has U.S. citizenship. That's another whole thing where he wasn't here during the Oslo Accords. So he wasn't eligible for a Palestinian passport. So he only has U.S. citizenship. So he traveled via the airport. He took my kids with him. And then we met in Amman so that we can travel to the U.S. And then coming back, we had to do the same thing so he can bring them back.
And then so he went through... He went through the Lid airport,
the airport,
the one that's close to Tel Aviv, and you had to go out through Jordan.
Yes. And there was one time that when my father was ill and he was recuperating in Switzerland, where my sister lived at the time, and we were going to help my sister, and I had my kids with me. My husband wasn't with me, but they were too young to travel alone. I had to get an escort, you know, for the plane, and I had to have my brother and my brother-in-law take them to the airport and make sure they're on the plane. And I traveled through Jordan the night before. I mean, it was really stressful. And that was how we traveled for years and years and years. Now that they're older, they can travel on their own. But this is not something unique to me. I mean, there are thousands of people.
The law expired earlier this month and has not been renewed, mostly due to attempts on the part of the fascist parties to try to extract concessions and to impose even more onerous conditions on Palestinians. That said, however, there are amendments to the law being planned, which will likely make it even more difficult for such spouses. In the meantime, for those like Joetta, they remain in limbo, waiting for new permits to reside in Jerusalem.
So now that the law has not passed, it didn't pass. The law has expired effectively, and it hasn't passed. What do you think is going to happen, or what are your hopes?
I try not to pin too many hopes on their system because I know that the policy is the same whether this law passes or not. So I don't know. I mean, best case scenario, I will be granted Jerusalem ID. Worst case scenario is that I'll be the way I've been for the past 23 years, sometimes with a permit, sometimes not. But I don't have any illusions that the Israeli legal system is in my favor. So we will do what we can in order to maintain a life that any Palestinian deserves in Jerusalem. And, we fight for it, not just for ourselves, but for the Palestinians here in general and for Jerusalem in general. But I don't have any illusions that it's going to be in any of our favor.
Well, certainly not, especially since the first few years of your marriage was before this law was even enacted, and there were still ways of blocking you.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying, that they'll find a way. And the thing is with their system is that any little thing becomes an excuse why not to renew or why to revoke.
Well, Johara, thank you very much for sharing with us on This Is Palestine.
And thanks for having me.
I wish I could tell you that I'm optimistic about this law, but I am just as pessimistic as you are, if not more so. But I wish you strength, love, perseverance, and of course, happiness.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Deanna.
Thank you for listening to This Is Palestine, brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.